agriculture in the world. And so here we have a chance to say some words and remind people we're still here. We still have the same issues of land, of the environment, of water. Water for life, we say, which we say in our language, mini wichoni, water is life. And so we taught that phrase to the world during Standing Rock in the late, in the 2000, of, I think it was 2020, 2018, around there. So anyway, I leave you with those thoughts of, and again, okay. Leonard Peltier. He deserves to be free. He's been in jail for almost 60 years. And so here we are, or is it, I think it's 40 years. Anyway, it's a long time. It's a lifetime.
It's a lifetime.
46 years. So I wanted to get that part straight because he deserves to be paroled or freed because of humanitarian issues, if nothing else. Just let him be in his later years. Let him go home.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 11 a.m. Next up, it's the Bike Show.
Welcome to the KBO Radio Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon on 90.7 FM and streaming live across the universe on HTTPS, two dots and two exclamation marks, KBO.FM. And all our shows are also available on www.bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. My name is Alon Robb, and I will be joined today by co-host Nedra Deadweiler. Our engineer today is Ty Walker. I hope this day finds you well and healthy. In Portland, we had a few snowy and icy days. I waited till the snow and ice melted before I got on my bike, but I noticed some hardy souls plowing through, ignoring the elements. Next month, one of our guests will be geoscientist, writer, and commercial airline pilot Jessica Cherry, who is also co-editor of Wheels on Ice, Stories and Accounts of Cycling in Alaska since the 1890s. She will speak to us from Anchorage, Alaska, about some of the challenges and joys of cycling in the snow and on frozen lakes. I'm happy to be joined today by co-host Nedra Deadweiler. Hello, Nedra. How are you today?
Hello, Alon. I'm doing great. How about yourself?
We're okay here. The snow is melted at last after five interesting days. Any snow in your part of the world?
Oh, no. We have our first spring. Not to be confused with spring.
Ah. Well, the spring is a rumor here right now, but lots of water, lots of rain. Everything will be green and beautiful. And you're preparing for a festival this weekend, right? What is that festival?
Yes. The festival is called Save Your Spaces, and it is a festival that is a Skillshare of preservation, skills, documentation, oral history, cemeteries. The idea that we are all responsible for the preservation of our history, cultural spaces, and heritage. In order to maintain that connection, that sense of identity, belonging, purpose, and, you know, really kind of direction. So that's what's happening. It's an all day from like sessions, roundtables, discussions, art activation, and some a marketplace, and in the evening, poetry and film screenings.
Wow, sounds wonderful. I wish I could be there with you. Maybe next year's festival.
Maybe
I'll
next
say,
year.
Yeah, I'll say goodbye to you for now, Nedra. You'll come back, of course, in half an hour. In the second half of the show, Nedra Deadweiler will speak with Kristen E. Jeffers, who is the founder and editor-in-chief of the Black Urbanist Multimedia Platform, as well as an author, textile artist, urban planner, activist, and of course, cyclist. Before that conversation, we will speak with Taylor Griggs, writer and reporter for the always excellent BikePortland.org. Taylor writes about various aspects of cycling and sustainable living in Portland and beyond, and is a writer that I always look forward to reading and learning from. Good day, Taylor, and welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Before we get to some of your writings, I would like to ask you a little bit about your background. Were you always a cyclist? And if so, what are some of your early cycling memories?
Yeah, this is interesting for me. I guess I never really referred to myself that way, but I rode my bike from a young age, and it was always important and fun for me. I was thinking back when I first got the job at Bike Portland kind of about my cycling history, because it seems like it just sort of happened naturally. But I remembered I was really one of the only people in my high school who would ever bike to school, and everybody was kind of obsessed with having a car in that area, but I was fine with whatever I could use to get around as long as I could have transportation and didn't have to rely on my parents to take me around.
And that was in Colorado? Or?
Yes, in the suburbs of Denver. Ah.
And then you went to school in Eugene, right? The University of Oregon?
Yes.
What were your Eugene has a reputation as a good bicycle city. What were your impressions of Eugene as a cycling city?
Yeah, I biked everywhere for the majority of college. When I went there, it wasn't even really a question. I just immediately got a bike, and that was how I was going to get around. I just didn't know anything about infrastructure or anything like that. I just, and same when I was younger, I just kind of got around it and did what I could. But I remember, I think Eugene is a very nice place to bike for sure.
I'm familiar a little bit with Eugene and the university, and the advantage, one nice thing is it's very flat. There are a few hills, but most of the city is very flat and compact. A lot of the commercial areas are by the university, so and it's within a few, you know, maybe 10 minutes you're out of the city and you could ride in the hills. So
yeah,
the city I really enjoyed riding.
It's nice. And they have lots of people down there working on this stuff too, and I wish that I was more connected with them when I was there, but I didn't really start to know about all the infrastructure stuff until a little bit later.
And were you a writing major, an English major?
Yeah, I studied media studies and English.
Hmm. And what are some of the writers you like?
Oh, that's interesting. I don't know who have I like a lot of writers. I really read a lot of fiction novels. I like Zadie Smith, and I was reading Joan Didion recently. And but as far as journalists, I mean, about urban planning, there's lots of great people doing really cool stuff. I mean, nationally, David Zipper is always great. I'm having a hard time thinking of people, but anyone who writes for Streets Blog, it's such a really cool resource.
So you moved to Portland, and since you started covering Portland's bicycle universe, what are some surprising things you learned about cycling in Portland? Maybe the politics, the culture?
Surprising, I don't know. I think that it might surprise, I don't know if it was surprising to me, because I think Portland has a reputation for this kind of thing, but I think it might surprise people who don't know a lot about the cycling culture here, or in general, how divided it is. I mean, it's not really a community in many ways. There's lots of issues that people have completely different opinions on. And you'll see in the comments of any article on Bike Portland, people who you'd think have similar goals and motives really disagreeing on what someone might think is a small thing. But I think it's not necessarily a bad thing. I think it just shows people are really thoughtful and have strong opinions about what's it like to bike around the city. And I try to kind of take all of them in and maybe not identify strongly with any one necessarily. It depends on the topic, but I usually can see where most people are coming from. Sometimes a little harder too.
So different opinions within the bicycle community, and then there's of course the outer world, the car community, the public transportation.
Yes.
So within Portland's bicycle, you know, community, would you say the differences are along, you know, levels of radicality, for instance, or would you see these kind of different opinions? And I personally think a variety of opinions is a wonderful thing, as long as there's mutual respect and, you know, willingness to... our engineer is talking to the next guest, but okay, I guess we're back. Sorry for that. So where do you see the different divisions?
Levels of, I guess you could say that. I think that it's interesting because there's sometimes, there's really some philosophies in here that you could explore, like different, what's the term that I'm looking for? Vehicular cycling as kind of a philosophy, I would say, versus people who feel really strongly about having protected bike lanes and separate from car infrastructure, or people who kind of want everything to be the same. There's some conflict these days about e-bikes and whether or not they should be really fully embraced, which is something I feel really strongly about. I definitely support electric bikes, but there are some people who are skeptical of that. I would say that also different tactics of not protest maybe, but of getting the word across in messaging. Some people are really against having anything that they see as being kind of aggressive or would alienate people, especially people who drive, and they don't want to, you know, say anything that might deter them from supporting cycling. Mm-hmm. But other people are a lot more. It doesn't really matter kind of what they think.
Well, I could relate to what you're saying, having most of my life, or at least from my youth, been on the more radical side of things. So I participated in many critical mass rides, even the second critical mass ever in the world in San Francisco. And now I'm on the city's bicycle advisory committee. So I still feel there's room for different opinions, different, you know, and some things, you know, I've never used an e-bike in my life, and I hope as long as I'm able, I could still pedal up the hill by my house. But perhaps, you know, when I'm 85 or something, heaven forbid, happens that requires it, I'll use it. So personally, I think it's good to have various positions and perspectives, and I learn a lot from the different ones.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's really interesting. I don't know. There have been times where I have gotten in trouble. Well, I don't know trouble, but definitely faced some pushback. Yes. I wrote an article in October, November about a group called the Tire Extinguishers who use kind of like a lentil to put in the valve of a SUV tire, and who typically parked in wealthy neighborhoods and close in cities. And this started in the UK, I think, and is kind of active throughout Europe more than it is here. But it happened here, and a few news stations covered it, and sort of in a very one-sided perspective of, like, this is a terrible thing that happened and somebody was temporarily inconvenienced. And I wrote kind of an opinion piece posing an alternate view, not necessarily saying it's the best and most effective tactic, but that I think we should consider that these cars are doing real damage to our cities, and 20 minutes of inconvenience isn't necessarily the end of the world, because people who are biking and taking transit always experience those kinds of inconveniences.
And when you write in Bike Portland or other places, usually, I mean, there are articles that are more straight reporting and then opinion pieces. Do you have trouble separating the two, or...
Well, it's really nice that I feel like there's a lot of flexibility with this. Jonathan is the editor of Bike Portland. He's very open to kind of experimentation, I think. And it's also, he knows, and the readers know, that it's difficult to have a huge separation between yourself as a cyclist or an advocate and a journalist, and so your experiences are going to inform the way you report on things. I think that's true for every kind of journalism, and it annoys me when people pretend that they don't have opinions about right. things. But yeah, so some I really try to have stories, as you know, as airtight in it as they can be, including opinion pieces and using facts and being reasonable. But it, I guess it, I wouldn't say it's really difficult to separate, but there's sometimes a bit of a crossover, and I can be a little bit more, I guess, experimental with my tone or something than I may be able to somewhere else.
And you've also been car free for about a year. I read an article you wrote about your birthday. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
And, being car-free, how did that decision come about, and how do you find it so far?
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of forgot that the anniversary had passed, but I remembered that, and I thought I'd write something about it. I really wanted to sell my car for a while. I mean, at least a year before that, but I kind of just didn't get around to it. I don't know. I wrote in the article about this, it's embarrassing for me to think about how reliant I was on using a car, even as I knew that it was not necessary in a lot of different situations. And I don't know, I guess I didn't really think about it. But it's interesting how fast you can go from that to feeling completely differently. So I think I just... kind of once I fell into the urbanist world, I guess, and started learning a lot about transportation and everything, yeah, how that relates to kind of the environmentalism and climate action, it became clear to me that I couldn't I would never feel morally sound if I continue to own a car, and even giving up some of the things that I would do, which I mean, the reason it hasn't been a huge deal to me this anniversary is because this year has been perfectly normal. I can't really think of many, if any, occasion where it has posed a real inconvenience to me to not have a car. But I used to, go to the coast or go skiing every once in a while. Now it would be more of I'd have to plan that ahead of time more. But I don't like going to, like, beautiful natural areas driving a car. Like, it feels bad to me to do that. So there will never be a time in my life ever again that I will feel like comfortable doing that.
Never say never, but I hope you're right. And I could relate very well to what you were just saying. And I find that my existence without a car, you know, I'm fine. If I need to go someplace out of town, I use Amtrak, and I notice you mentioned trains, and that's always an exercise in patience and learning that life is full of unexpected mishaps and disasters and wonderful things. I plan to, if all goes well, to visit my homeland, I visit Jerusalem next year, and I'm thinking of taking a train to New York, a boat to Europe, and then maybe riding from France to Greece, and then taking a boat. So it could take me a few months, and that, of course, is a luxury of, you know, those who have the time. But I'm eager to try that. You know,
yes, so, I have not taken a boat across the Atlantic. But if that was an option, that I would try it out. I get kind of seasick, so I don't know how nice that would be.
We'll
but.
Find you a nice steady boat. You're listening to the KBO Radio Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon on 90.7 FM and streaming live on KBO.FM. All shows are also available on bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. My name is Alon Robb, and my co-host, who will be on the air in about 15 minutes, is Nedra Detweiler. And our first guest today is BikePortland.org writer and journalist Taylor Griggs, who is sharing her observations of cycling in Portland. And I will move on to beyond Portland, to your recent journey in Western Europe. Can you tell us a little bit about that journey, where you visited, maybe some of the people and organizations you met?
Yeah, so I was lucky to go to Europe, and for the month of January, I went because my sister is teaching English in Bilbao, Spain, and I... you know, I try to limit my travel, and I was, I want to, condense everything into one. So if I'm over there, I wanted to do as much as I could while I was there. So I got a train pass. I started in Brussels. I went to the Netherlands, Utrecht and Amsterdam. I went to Copenhagen, Hamburg, Germany, Paris, and then Spain, Bilbao, and Barcelona. And I, as far as organizations, I kind of left it myself pretty open to do a lot of exploring on my own and kind of talk to people as I found them. In Paris, there was an organization I was in contact with, but I plan to talk to them more because recently in Paris, they've had a big kind of transformation mm-hmm. of the city. It's something that was exciting to for me to see, and I wanted to visit because of it. But unfortunately, really early on in Paris, I hurt my hand and had to be in the hospital for a couple of days, and I didn't really feel like biking around a lot after that.
Your article on Paris was titled Biking in Paris, a Bumpy Road with an Optimistic Ending. And you also mentioned your somewhat fraught relationship with the City of Lights in the past. So hopefully in the future will be smooth sailing.
Yeah.
And Paris, of course, has a new mayor, a socialist, and her grandparents even fought in the Spanish Civil War against the fascists. From your observations of the places that are good for cycling, is there a connection between, you know, does it help if the mayor or the city council are green or socialist, or is it some of these places already have a long tradition of cycling, like Utrecht? What helps make a good bicycling city over there?
You know, I'm not sure about every mayor of all of these cities right now. I think that in places like the Netherlands and in Denmark, where there's cities where, have a very long tradition of this, not to say that there's not issues and that people don't have to continuously work to make their cities better there, but I would imagine that they would face significant pushback if there was any politician who kind of wanted to change and make it less bike friendly. But I'm sure that there's something like that going on in places. And just because it looks really ideal to us here doesn't mean that mm-hmm. it's perfect. I think that, well, and I wrote about these advisory bike lanes in Utrecht, which have been recently implemented in Portland and some places. They are, how do I describe, kind of on shared streets with cars, sort of dashed lines on the side. So when there is not somebody riding a bike on there, somebody in a car could use that lane if they needed to pass somebody. I'm not describing that super well, so you might want
to
see a
picture.
We'll just
have to go and ride over there. We'll
yes,
see.
but this is kind of a Dutch invention, and I liked it in Portland when I saw it. There's one on San Rafael in outer northeast, and a couple others. But in Utrecht, it's kind of incomparable because I think just the culture really supports being respectful to people biking. There's the mode share. There's so many more people biking there than there are here that you just feel a sense of safety in numbers. And you know that for the most part, people who are driving cars are really paying attention. They have it ingrained in the culture and in the planning that they need to watch out for people who are using these bike lanes. So it just feels a lot different there. So I would say, yeah, both by having a long history of biking and by continuously making the infrastructure better, you kind of teach both people who are biking and people who are in cars that they need to this is, yeah, kind of the order of it, and that people who are biking need to be prioritized.
Our time has just zoomed by. We have a few more minutes. So I'll ask you two quick questions. One is, what could Portland do to be closer to those cities? Because we had a wonderful bike plan from 2010 predicting and hoping for 25% ride share, travel share of bicycles in 2030, and now it's stagnated at about 7%. And the next question after that, I'll combine the two if I may, is what's next for you in your crystal ball? Where are you going to be in 10 years? So maybe
okay.
Portland and the world, and then your own personal future.
I feel optimistic about Portland because there's so many amazing advocates here who feel really strongly about this and I think are very smart and have a lot of determination to make Portland a better place to bike. I don't know. This is always the question of really how it's going to happen, and I think it will take a lot of different tactics, but it is going to be really important to get people out of their cars. I mean, just because it makes you feel so much safer to bike in a place where less people are driving cars, that's going to have to be we'll have to be more aggressive about that by barricades in the street or closing off streets to cars, having, you know, just prioritizing people using active transportation more than we do right now. So I think it will take, yeah, a more a more aggressive stance, I guess. As far as me, I don't know. I mean, I've really enjoyed learning so much about biking and infrastructure. I think, I mean, it's so interesting to me and important that I can't imagine doing something else. You were asking if I would write a book. I don't know. I mean, there's lots of things I could write. I feel like I feel too new and to really have any sort of authority on anything. But there are lots of anecdotes I write down and will come back to in the future, maybe. But yes, I'll continue doing this for now.
Well, whatever you do in the future. I personally really appreciate what you do in the present, and I always, as I said, I always look forward to your articles. I find them a nice combination of insight, knowledge, and curiosity about the world, which I think is a great combination.
Thank you. That's very nice.
Yeah. You are listening to the KBO Radio Bike Show, hosted by Nedra Deadweiler and Alon Raab. The show can be heard live on 90.7 FM, streaming on kbu.fm, and all the shows going back to 2002, if you could believe that, are archived on bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. And we've been speaking with writer and journalist Taylor Griggs, who shared some of the stories she has been covering and some of the motivations and experiences that she brings to her work. Thank you very much, and much success with your writing and life.
Thank you for having me.
And in the second half of the show, Nedra Deadweiler will speak with Kristen E. Jeffers, who is the founder and editor-in-chief of the Black Urbanist multimedia platform, as well as an author, textile artist, urban planner, and activist. Are you on the air, Nedra?
Yes, I am here. We are here.
All right. Welcome
yes,
to
here.
Welcome to the show, Kristen. And take it from here, Nedra.
Okay, that was a great interview by Alon Raab with Taylor Griggs of BikePortland.org. It is my delight to welcome you, Kristen, to KBU Radio. Thank you for accepting the invitation and joining us. I am going to read your bio. So Kristen Jeffers is a Black queer feminist urbanist advocate for equity, inclusion, and accessibility. She is the creator and steward of the Black Urbanist Media Platform, a former communications and membership manager of Bike Walk KC, a former member of Greensboro, North Carolina Bike Share Task Force, a speaker and interviewer on transportation equity and urbanism. She lives with her partner, Les Henderson, just outside of D.C., was born and raised in Greensboro, North Carolina, a Southerner, and is looking forward to the promise of e-assist bikes to make them drive their shared car even less. Kristen is also a prolific crocheter under the banner of Kristen Pattern. Kristen Jeffers, thank you for joining us today. So, you are a longtime writer, thinker, advocate, planner, and you continue to do that today. I would love to just start off with something kind of introductory, kind of to get to know you. Can you hear me okay? Kristen? Hello, Kristen?
We lost her. We'll try to get her back.
I don't think she can hear. She's on. Oh, sorry. We just had a kerfuffle. Hi, will you please give Kristen a call back?
Yeah, I'm calling now.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, she's back. You're on the air.
Hello, Kristen. Okay.
Okay.
I'm getting good.
Yeah, I'm
Hello?
Getting this feedback. Okay.
Sounds like a phone is off the hook. Okay. Sorry there. We're back on. I think everything is good now. So welcome back. Kristen, just want to get an introductory of who you are. Would like to start off with you, in your material, you talk about that your father was the one who helped you to bring that urbanism to mind. He is the one who influenced you. Can you just describe his influence on you as an urbanist and what that means for you personally? We're not hearing you.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now. Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you all for your patience. It's so great to be here, y'all. So, yes, like she said, so it's my dad gave me paper maps because we're talking about the time period around late 80s, early 90s. And I've always had a trike. It went from like a Hot Wheels trike that I could ride in the house to like a more metal trike. And then there was a training wheels bike. And then there was a man around the corner in our neighborhood. And just for some context, when I used to tell this story, this is before we had kind of had this latest awakening of thinking about spatial justice and mobility justice. And so let me paint the picture for you. I grew up in Greensboro, North Carolina. We were still very much a mill town where anybody who wanted to go work at the mill could, and that was black, white, immigrant families. Both of my parents worked for the school system. We had just moved maybe right when I was born in 1985 into a neighborhood that used to be a white neighborhood. It was built after World War II. There was like a for sale portion of it, and then there was a portion that was built for white families that needed public housing. By 1985 through the 1990 period when we lived there, there were still white homeowners in the different homes, and we were, my parents started renting the home, then they lived in the home, and we're talking like the little 2x1 matchbox houses. There's a backyard and a front yard. There's a small street. There's no sidewalks. This is still North Carolina. There's no mandated sidewalks, but there's sidewalks on the main road. We lived kind of behind a strip shopping center. There used to be a grocery store there, but by the time we got there, that grocery chain had closed it. Most of the folks in the public housing were African American. There was a senior portion to it which I used to ride my bike, and those seniors would sit on the front porches. Once again, we're still in North Carolina. These homes, while they may not look like that in Portland and other places, they do have that element in North Carolina of the front porch. And so there are people on the front porches of the for sale homes and the rental homes. There are people on the front porches of the senior housing that's under the sort of the public housing banner. And then there was a health center, and my first elementary school was right around the corner. And so this kind of compact neighborhood, and it was kind of several neighborhoods that had kind of been built together kind of in the period between like 1950 and 1970. And so and I navigated those neighborhoods. My parents were fortunate. They worked for the school system, as I mentioned before. And so they had, at least in that time period, being a teacher and a maintenance worker, definitely still afforded a middle-class family setup, maybe like lower-working middle-class family setup. My mom stayed at home. She eventually went back to the classroom. But that was kind of not in this period. Like in the period from, I would say, ages like four and a half to nine, it was me and my dad on the weekend tinkering with the bikes in the backyard. There was a man, a black man, kind of, I would consider it around the corner, but we're still dealing with somewhat of a suburban layout. So we're looping around, then around again, and then this man is here, with lots of bikes, children's bikes, adult bikes, and he's basically reselling bikes. He's kind of in front of my elementary school. So that, we would ride up there sometimes, and then we had cousins that lived a little further away, but we're still talking about like roads that are neighborhood streets. No pavement markings, but people still kind of, they slowed down. They stayed. They didn't really try to speed. People just, and then it, once again, this might have been because we're living in the South in the 90s, and this is just how, but that's kind of the origin story. So I just grew up on the weekends riding, and then when we did go out to sort of the six-lane highways, my dad taught me how to walk the intersection, you know, everything from maybe stand on your bike instead of like sitting on it. And so I had a bike up until about, I had a brand new bike, I will say, up until about age 9. And so my parents split, and so they don't move too far away from each other, but my mom effectively moves further out into a neighborhood. Well, we move into an apartment complex first, and so outside of really circling the apartment complex, I wasn't biking in the same way unless I went over to visit with my dad, but it was oftentimes we would have to exchange the bike when my parents would do their visitation exchange. My mom had siblings living in other states and other neighborhoods like that, so I would bring the bike and ride it over to Summers, maybe. We would go to, we have these wonderful regional parks in Greensboro. Those of you listening who know our regional park system, my dad would put the bikes in, like, in the back of his, like, work, like, personal work van, or that he used for, like, doing maintenance jobs, or I might come with him on a maintenance job, and it might be, like, a street that has, like, low traffic, and so we would ride there. But my last brand new bike, at least in that era, was probably age 9. Then I tried to get other bikes. It stopped being cool. Like, you know, there was same thing with my roller skating. I also used to roller skate, but then I quit doing that for a while because it wasn't cool. And then, of course, you know, we're living in car culture. The encouragement is to get your license, which after a few hard tries, I got that license. I believe this was probably like 2002, 2003. I know it's a little bit later than my classmates because it took me a while to adjust to piloting my parents' vehicles, which were, in my mom's case, a Buick LeSabre, and my dad's case, these vans, these like big Dodge Ecoliner maintenance vans. And so then that's kind of the origin story, really, kind of asked about my father. Like, it was really both parents encouraging me. My mom, even when we would go visit her siblings, she got a bike rack for the back of the car. And of course, those of you who maybe heard my story before, I usually talk about the dad part, but mom's in there too as well. And she's definitely in there with a lot of the adventures I've gotten into during the pandemic. So
thank you for sharing it, Kristen, because I think in your description of just sharing your life story around your bike story, as well as how you started to understand and learn about urbanism, you talked about the landscape, you talked about environment, infrastructure, house typology, roadway design, green spaces, direction in relationship to other type of spaces, or how you use a space, mobility, biking, walking, riding in a car or van, the stage of life and age and how that relates to all of that, and what the environment supports, and also having gear with a car rack. I mean, gear sometimes become very important in how we are living our lives and this whole urbanist mindset. So thank you for, like, really having that deep dive, sharing personally, but also giving a synopsis, this understanding of what urbanism means. And so if we're thinking about urbanism, you know, it's kind of a planning term. The APA, the American Planning Association, in 2021 developed this list of 11 Black urbanists that every planner should know. I'm just going to name a few. W.D. Du Bois, Gordon Parks, John Hope Franklin, Dorothy May Richardson, and Mary Petillo. And the last two I'm just going to say, Dorothy May Richardson, she was an organizer and advocate for against redlining in Pittsburgh. And Mary Petillo is a professor around African-American history, maybe Northwestern University. But you have your own canon. You probably coined the phrase Black, queer, feminist, urbanist. And you have a canon of writers, thinkers. Who are we missing? You know, we're talking about expanding how we see space and place. Who are we missing when we're talking about things? Who would you add to that list?
Well, honestly, when we're talking about spatiality, honestly, we should start with people that are in our own communities. Like, this is a community-based discipline. Now, yes, there are, when it comes to architecture, there's certain things we do. Yes, but honestly, there's there's somebody in your community, and that's what I really want to encourage, is somebody in your community that carries the oral history of what was there and why it was there. And sometimes, unfortunately, because of the pain and possible anguish, and of course, our inordinate focus on kind of Black trauma and Black pain and some of it being tied to home, we don't always get those stories. But of course, when I talk about my canon, I've added folks like Audre Lorde, just so we center ourselves in what Black feminism in a, from a queer lens means. I've added, because I'm working with a lot of conditions where we're talking about people who've been traumatized by land use and the lack of access, things like The Body's Not an Apology, Sonya Renee Taylor's book. I bring that into this practice by telling people, you know, love your body where it is. Then get to know how to transport said body. Then when you realize, okay, well, if I have ability challenges, or if I'm there's things I was born to not do, like I was born not seeing in a traditional way, I was born not hearing in a traditional way, I was born without certain limbs that are expected, however, I'm demanding that the world make a way for me, and it should. That's where we are with accessibility. So not only is it like, yes, recognize Black women, and of course we're at Women's History Day, recognize people of the queer community and the trans spectrum, whatever gender identity is brought to the table and presented to people and what's going on the inside, recognizing our class distinctions, which is why I wanted to spell out what kind of neighborhood and talk about what my parents did, because oftentimes we try to universalize the Black experience and we can't. And I've seen my work universalized against someone else, and like, but that person's not going to have that same experience. They're not going to feel that same way. They're not, everybody's going to come to this at the same pace. So I say reading all the people you are told to read when people say read a Black feminist list, read a Black like study list, and look at how they establish a sense of place in their work. I think I take that for granted because I grew up in the U.S. South, and like the Southern writing canon really establishes this is where we are. If you read Dora Neale Hurston, which she does a great example, or Toni Morrison, there's an establishment of where you're living. There's worlds of books that live in an apartment, or it's like anything like A Tree Goes in Brooklyn. Like there's that place specificity, and so encourage folks to start with fiction and find yourself in fiction, and then go to folks like say Retrofitting Suburbia, both the case study series as well as the original book, because in a lot of ways that's kind of a looking from a feminist, admittedly a white feminist lens, at how to retrofit places and spaces that may have been built to be oppressive. Everything from the empty Walmart that just is left there and they don't care and it just sits there and rots, to, you know, and how these different places are converted. Then asking the questions about, especially when you're looking at the first book, is this place still operating? Is this church affirming of like all gender identities and class levels and everything, or this house of faith? Like starting there. And then yes, reading if you're in a formal academic setting, reading everything on your syllabus and asking the hard questions about it, everything from reading The Power Broker, going back to reading, I'm trying to think of some other, I mean, I'm adding to this canon as you go along, and if you go to my website, you'll see specific books, but if I was going to recommend one book for you to start with, it's going to be two, because they're both named Chocolate Cities. If the book has Chocolate Cities on it, it's okay to read them both. One of them is a more specific deep dive into the racial history of D.C. and this concept that how D.C. became the Chocolate City. And then there is Chocolate City's A Black Map of American Life, Dr. Zandria Robinson and Marcus, of course, I'm forgetting your last name. You know, look up Chocolate City's A Black Map of American Life. You will not miss these two wonderful Black scholars who integrate all of that we've been talking about, and then instead of, you know, using the West as a marker, everything is a South. So you're literally getting a re-spatialized African American specifically African Americans that were brought through the process of enslavement and then freed from enslavement and then brought into these other systems of oppression, like the Great Migration, and in the kind of where we are now, where we're facing, okay, do we suburbanize? Do in the face of gentrification, do we stay put? Do we push our cities to do better by us? What, of course, what's happening in Portland with the reparations and with the goal to bring folks back to certain neighborhoods, is that like working out for specific family dynamics? But Chocolate City's books, if you're going to start somewhere, start there. And of course, you know, just hop on the cannon and see how far we go, because it's just like my life is a journey, this work's a journey. It is an evolving journey of adding books and adding things to the cannon.
Okay, I have to say this, that Mary Petillo, she writes specifically about the Black middle class and some of the myths and privileges that the Black middle class has, and to bring up the concept of class and class differentials and how that looks in the landscape and also how that presents in urbanist space and mobility, all kinds of things happen, especially when we get to those two things, urbanism and mobility. Do you want to give, I wanted to talk about something else you just said, but this other question is coming to me now, which is, would you like to say anything about that aspect of mobility while being Black? Because you've talked about it and you've also expressed about it. May not be in your current mode right now, but just say a thing.
I do want to, especially as we're going into this time period between Women's History Month and when most folks observe Pride Month, there is still, when you talk about looking at Black folks not as a monolith, but as a whole faceted group of people that happen to have African ancestry and happen to have certain skin tones and happen to have experience with particular marginalizations, anything from ancestor enslavement to elders during Jim Crow to current issues of being afraid of being pulled over, incarceration, underpayment, doing a lot of work, tokenization, all those things are still pieces. And so for me, that is why I called it the Black queer feminist urbanism that I'm practicing. That's why I'm presenting a different framework. Because we're now, you've probably heard about Black urbanism. You probably can name, if you're listening to this show, you can name, other than Metro, you can name some of our colleagues and friends out here that are, you know, of course, if everybody has those lovely, like, Bicycling magazines from 2020, you can name at least one other person. But there's also young people, there's people experiencing homelessness, that the bike is their one thing. There's people who can't operate a vehicle for any reason. There's people who found cycling because of the pandemic for various reasons. And yes, we are all in the Black community and we all have a Black experience with our bikes, with using transit, with choosing to drive and not to drive. We all have those unique experiences. And so mine is informed by me as a queer, non-binary femme who womanhood, questions other feminism, even questions other expressions of Blackness, say, from that are patriarchal and sexist and, you know, Christo-fascist. And yes, it does exist within the Black community. Like, so just bringing that to the table and then highlighting, and over the next few months, I'm really going to be digging deep into a project of really how I rank things, like putting a data point to it. But this is really an anecdotal project. This is really oral history. This is really storytelling and spoken history and honoring that piece that has been part of the African-American experience.
Okay, we have five minutes. 4 to 5 minutes. And so last question for you, Kristen. You know, a lot of big ideas. I think you're a fantastic thinker, and you really put nice phraseology around things and make it pretty direct and simple. I really appreciate, as a Southerner myself, that you really bring in the aspect of being Southern and also what it means to grow up here and to question that authority, because there is an authority that is in the South.
Yeah.
So to push back against it, what does that mean? So my last question for you is that as we understand equity as it continues to roll along, and there are more pieces that are pulled onto it. We are starting to realize, at least, you know, that Vanguard is starting to realize that there's this collective mindset. There's a reorientation to the natural spaces and nature-based practices, that we must be grounded in spirit. And I'm wondering, what does this transition, what has it meant to you? What is it meaning to you? How do you see this for yourself and for your work and for community at large?
Well, really, I'm excited about the e-bike kind of thing happening. I know a lot of folks are concerned, especially in communities where there's been high adoptional speed, cost, everything. Like, I think we need to do this sooner rather than later. And then we sort through, okay, we have a lot of e-bikes now. What do we do next? Because I live in D.C. We have a lot of hills. We have a lot of river bluff type hills. That is a mobility issue. And of course, not, I live in a part of DC that's not part of like the core around the monument. I live around the part that's constantly marginalized as just one neighborhood when there's multiple neighborhood names. We're still very close to the Potomac. We are very close to the trail system, but we also at the moment live next to a 6-lane state highway. And even though Prince George's County, Maryland is one of the wealthiest black counties in America, and of course our throne has only been taken by a nearby county, Charles County, we live in this cluster of black wealth, but we are missing a lot of key places to bike. In fact, there's I want to shout out really more of a friend of mine, PG on Two Wheels on Twitter. She's literally living biking every day on our 6-lane state highways in Maryland, trying to grocery shop and do all these things. And so that, you may not feel comfortable. I don't necessarily feel comfortable riding, but that doesn't mean that it's not happening. And younger people are trying, but we still deserve those bike infrastructures. We deserve to be at the table, and we deserve to take the lead with some professional guidance. Like, you can professionally guide, say you're an infrastructure designer, you design the pylon, you pick the paint color. Well, you can still ask the neighborhood member to say, hey, so we need a paint color. What do you think about the paint color? Hey, can you help me measure, like, the comfort distance? Can you stick your hands out? Put your hands up. Like, there are, our bike world will stop being like a microcosm of the real, like, the whole world when we include everyone, and when we include these specific things, and when we do our engagement not as, oh no, we have to publicly engage or we have to practice equity, but when we just lean into what the ground is telling us, and not the folks that are saying, oh, we don't need this, but the folks that are asking and the folks that want it and the folks that with nudging and the right funding and the right support and the right overarching comprehensive infrastructure overhaul. Like, it may be painful, but you might need to close streets down and do the infrastructure overhaul at once, or say we're going to shut the bus system down for a night and then reconfigure it all, and then the bus comes a different way the next morning. We should be ready to do that, like, because otherwise you're going to leave people out, and you're not going to have the adoption that you want. Or if you have to do adoption and teaching of the community and behavior change, it's not going to feel comfortable in that same way. But doing those major infrastructure changes side by side with the community and being courageous enough to do them, using this federal moment, this federal funding moment, to make those changes, especially for communities that, not just the Portland community, but any of the bike communities listening nationwide, be courageous and be willing to reach out and really meet the communities you want to meet where they are, and honor their knowledge, and y'all sit together at the table and you create a new knowledge soup together.
All right. Thank you, Kristen, for that bit of wisdom and advice. It is okay to make the hard decision, and it's okay to be uncomfortable. Thank you for joining me, Alon, and the cable audience. Back to you, Alon.
Okay. Thank you both for a wonderful interview and all the good work both of you do in the world. And I like that ending, be courageous, a wonderful reminder. You have been listening to the KBOO Bike Show. My name is Alon Robb, And I would like to thank our guests, Taylor Griggs and Kristen Jeffers, for being on the show and also for the good work they do in the world. Also, my co-host, Nedra Deadweiler, who, if I could give a small plug for her, her website, civilbikes.com, contains information about the wonderful things that Nedra does, the good work she does, including an op-ed called Reflections After the First Save Your Spaces Festival. So that's at civilbikes.com. Thank you also to our engineer, Ty Walker, Chris Smith, and Josh Hedrick for making all shows available on bikeshow.portlandtransport.com, and to you, our listeners. And I hope that the coming month is a good one for you and the world. I hope that the days ahead will see more actions towards making our home, the Earth, more bike-friendly, environmentally conscious, and centered on human and planetary needs. Thank you for joining us today. May all your rides be safe, enlightening, and joyful.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 11:59 a.m.
KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Jazz Lives, right after these news headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.